listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, and solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And please do show your support at KRUUFM.com. And where you can also live stream or listen to archives of past shows. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we have two guests today. I do have a guest host for the second half, but my mother, Caroline Kilborn, whom you are used to hearing here beside me, is not with us today. We sort of have a theme for today, which I think you'll figure out as we go along. Our first guest is Julia Tertian. Now, Julia is a food writer. She's a recipe developer and author of the best-selling Small Victories. She and her family live in upstate New York, and the book that we're talking about today is Feed the Resistance, Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved. Proceeds of this book will be donated to the ACLU. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Julia.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm delighted to talk to you about the book.
Oh, we're delighted to have you. Tell me a little bit about what inspired this book, as if I couldn't figure it out.
So the book happened really quickly. And just for a little context, most cookbooks take at minimum 2 years from proposal to, you know, being on a shelf or, you know, in a kitchen. So this book happened in about 6 months, so it was very fast, and I was actually on deadline to write a whole other book, and instead wrote my editor a one-page email that was just sort of this really fast pitch, and it was the end of February, so it was about a month after the presidential inauguration, and I had gotten increasingly involved in my own community. I was feeling the difference that made in my life, and you know the lives of the folks I was serving. And I realized that kind of call to action that I had responded to after the election was something lots of people were feeling. So I reached out to over 20 of just the smartest people I know in food to find out how they were using food to resist and to be part of community building and part of taking care of their neighbors. And we put all of this content together, and the result is the book, which is, you know, it's over 20 contributors, it's over 30 recipes or essays, there's a list of resources, and all of the proceeds from the book go directly to the ACLU. So, you know, buying the book in and of itself is just a very tangible and easy way to support the protection of civil liberties.
Wow. So, Julia, your previous book, Small Victories, was also recipes plus advice plus hundreds of ideas for home cooking triumphs. It was named one of 2016's best cookbooks by lots of people. And Feed the Resistance, of course, is also more than a cookbook. So I'd like to talk to you about how cookbooks can be more than just recipe books and what draws you to doing that kind of writing. Some of my favorite cookbooks of all time are like that. There was one, I wish I could remember the author. She has passed away, Lori something.
Lori Colwin? Is that who you're talking about?
It might be. And even some of the cookbooks that I inherited from my grandmother, some of them were like that. They were much more than just recipes. There were stories involved.
Yeah.
So, I think it's pretty obvious the link between storytelling and food, but not too many people take that into book form.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great question. I appreciate it. Because I think you can't separate food from our lives. And food for me is the way I get to explain who I am. It's how I get to understand other people and their life experiences and where they come from. And I've been I've been cooking my entire life, since before I can remember, since I was a really, really young child. I've always loved food. I've always been drawn to the kitchen. And I've also known I've always wanted to write cookbooks. I taught myself to cook from reading cookbooks, from being exposed to them. You know, I got to really better understand the world because I got to grow up, you know, with cookbooks, and I was always allowed to buy whatever cookbook I wanted. That was, you know, always something that was allowed in the house I grew up in. So, you know, my passion was very much encouraged, which is something I appreciate and I'm grateful for. So, you know, while I love food more than anything, and it's the thing I enjoy, and I love cooking at home, and, you know, I'm privileged to get to eat however much I want to eat, whatever I want, The stories behind the food have always been just as, if not even more important than the food itself. And so in Small Victories, my cookbook that came out last year, you know, it's a collection of recipes. It's sort of a traditional cookbook in many ways. But as you said, it's a bit more than a cookbook. And my goal with that book was to really dismantle this idea that cooking has to be difficult because it doesn't have to be. And it doesn't have to be complicated to be good. And, you know, so every single recipe, the title of the book comes through in the recipes because each recipe has a sort of quote-unquote small victory. So, you know, like a tip or a technique that just makes cooking a little bit easier. And then each recipe is followed by a number of variations. So the idea is once you know that tip or technique, you can make, you know, the main thing, but you can also make so many other things. So it's this idea of just being comfortable in the kitchen, using whatever you have, being creative. And along the same lines, Feed the Resistance, you know, is about food, it's about recipes, but it's about so much more than that. It's about the stories behind those recipes and, you know, who's making them and how this food fits into all of these amazing contributors' lives and how they use food to bring people together, how they use food to provide opportunity. There's one essay from Jordan Lexton, who runs this incredible organization called Drive Change in New York City, and it's a program for reentering citizens. So Jordan works with folks, mostly young people, who are coming out of the prison system, and they work on Jordan's food truck. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about getting, you know, paid on the job training. It's about getting a supportive community. It's about getting, you know, economic opportunity. It's about, you know, helping citizens who are reentering to have, you know, substantial, meaningful lives. So, you know, it's about food, but it's about so much more than
right.
food.
I mean, it's about being able to have a job at all for many of them, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you're right. Lori Colwin was the food writer I was thinking
of. Yeah, she was remarkable. She unfortunately passed away when she was so young.
Yeah.
She's one of my favorite writers. And
me too.
Yeah.
So in this book, you've got, you know, the history of a lot, the cultural history of a lot of the recipes also. And, you know, you're putting the whole thing, the food and the resistance, in a broader historical perspective.
Yeah, I think it was very important for me, two things. One, that the book, you know, all the contributors, it was, you know, that it'd be a very diverse group of contributors, meaning not just, you know, along the lines of race and gender, but also just where they live, where they come from, what their experiences and perspectives are. It's a very, you know, intersectional group of people. And it was also important to me that the book, you know, be very much rooted in this moment in time, but also that it really, you know, look backwards and understand that, you know, it stands on the shoulders of, you know, just generations of people who have been resisting in all different ways. And there's a great legacy of food in the history of civil rights and human rights. And because when we talk about these things, we're talking about people and communities and, you know, people need to be fed, you know, sometimes literally, but always literally, but also, you know, food is just, it's the easiest way I know of creating community and just bringing people together, making them feel taken care of. You know, you think about how you feel when someone in your community invites you over for a meal, and what you know, what a sort of embrace that is.
Oh, absolutely, and you know, food insecurity is actually a pretty big issue right now. In a lot of, certainly it is in our rural community here, which many people aren't aware of. You know, Fairfield's a small town, 10,000 people, seems to be prosperous. But as I understand it, 40% of the students in the public school qualify for assistance, meal assistance. And
Yeah, it's, food insecurity is a huge issue. I'm glad you brought it up because it's such an important one, and it's one that is, just as you said, it's often not understood how widespread it is. And I also live in a small rural community. I live in a hamlet that's, our population is about 500, so it's really small. And I'm very active in our local food pantry, which is basically a large closet in our local firehouse. And we serve so many people in our community, and, you know, often food insecurity is, you know, it's assumed someone who doesn't, you know, who might be homeless or, you know, any kind of extreme, and, you know, that, of course, exists, but it exists, you know, for sort of everyday Americans and people, you know, who are living paycheck to paycheck, and, you know, something comes up, you know, as things do, and sometimes, you know, you just can't put enough food on your table for your family, and it happens everywhere all the time. And it's not for lack of food, it's for lack of resources. So yeah, it's something that I think about a lot. I work with in my own community, and I'm glad that there's a lot of people working on, you know, big systematic levels to really, you know, try and untangle some things.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Julia Tertian, author of Feed the Resistance, Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved. And Julia, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yes, you are. Great. Yes, thank you.
Great. So I was kind of amazed that you put this book together so quickly. And I'm assuming that working with Chronicle Books helped in that.
Yeah, I definitely am so delighted to work with Chronicle and to be one of their authors, and I'm not just saying that. They were so supportive. As I said, I wrote, you know, a one-page pitch. I asked that we do a book they weren't planning on, that we do it immediately, that they, you know, trust that all these people that I wanted to bring in to be part of the book were, you know, just as amazing as I said they would be. And that they make no money, that we give all the proceeds to the ACLU. And to Chronicle's credit, you know, they were immediately on board.
Wow.
And I'm so delighted that they saw the potential of this book and the impact it could make, you know, that they understood that not everything that we make has to just be, you know, profit-driven, you know, that we can work on something together that's about giving back and hopefully giving people lots of just really kind of proactive, productive information, ways to get involved in their community. And, you know, it's been wonderful to work with them on this.
And really good recipes, too.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. Yeah, the food is great, and there's food from just everywhere. And it's this book is so much a, you know, a great sum of many parts. And I really feel like it's strong because it's the work of so many. And, you know, I reached out to people who live across the country who come from so many different places, and the result is just a mix of food that is, it's amazing. It's everything from, you know, tikka masala, macaroni and cheese, to a Brazilian fish pot pie that is so, so delicious. You know, all the way to, you know, a spiced brown sugar pound cake and, what else? Amazing biscuits and
the
Japanese chocolate espresso pie bars and
the Japanese sweet potatoes, roasted tomato sauce and polenta. That it looks like
you know, adobo. There's everything.
Yeah. Now, for the essays, not all of the chefs that you represent in here wrote essays, but a good number of them did. What did you, you know, what direction, what guidance did you give? What did you ask for that?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. So all the contributors from the recipes to the essays, you know, I wasn't very prescriptive about what I was asking for. You know, I didn't have a specific table of contents in mind that I was asking people to fill. I really wanted to, you know, have everyone bring whatever material they thought was best to the table, you know, sort of literally. And so what I did was I reached out to everyone kind of explaining my vision for the book, what I thought the book could kind of look and feel like, what purpose it could serve, you know, why I wanted to do it, why I thought they, you know, were, you know, the right people to get on board. You know, so I really explained the kind of why behind the book, the ethos of it, the feeling. And then, you know, they kind of responded in kind. And the result is so much richer than I could have ever even imagined on my own, because I don't think we were limited to just, you know, my thoughts. Mm-hmm. So for the essays, you know, not everyone who contributed to the book is a chef, which was definitely purposeful because I wanted, you know, a range of perspectives about food that weren't just from people who, you know, cook professionally. So, you know, I mentioned that essay from Jordan Lexton who runs Drive Change. So, you know, there's everything from that to Shakira Simley wrote this very, very moving, powerful essay about how, you know, food can be a means of activism, how the spaces in which we gather to eat food, those can be places to have really important conversations. And she offers a conversation she had herself with her brother, and it's very mm-hmm. personal, it's very emotional, and it's impactful. There's also an essay from Caleb Zegas, who runs, he's the director of a program called La Cocina in San Francisco, which is, it's a food business kind of incubation program. They have big commercial kitchens. They help train people to run businesses, and they work exclusively with immigrant women, and they help them get their food businesses off the ground. They give them all sorts of tools and resources in addition to just, you know, the time and space to make their products. You know, I met this woman, Alicia, recently, who went through La Cocina. She started her business. She was selling tamales that she made at home on the street in San Francisco, I believe, like, you know, on a cart. She now runs this amazing, amazing business in the Bay Area called Alicia's Tamales Los Mayos, and I believe she's in a 6,000 square foot space. She has a bunch of employees. They're making, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of tamales every day. She, you know, sells them wholesale and caters, and they're amazing tamales. They're delicious. And even better than that, you know, she is, she's supporting herself, her family. She's, you know, able to provide jobs for all these people who work for her. You know, she's really changing the lives of the people around her, including her own life, you know, through food. So there's such a just range of stories and inspiration in the book, and, you know, the opportunities that come through food are just, they're immense.
Well, Julia, could you read a little bit from the book?
Sure. Do you know that the copy that was on my desk I just gave away?
Oh, no!
Can you give me one second?
Okay.
And I'll go grab it?
Certainly. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Julia Tertian. She's going to read from Feed the Resistance, Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved. The proceeds from this book will be donated to the ACLU. It is published by Chronicle Books, and I'm sure it's available pretty much wherever books are sold. Almost any book that we talk about on the show can be ordered by through your local bookstore, which we always like to support the local bookstores. So do that whenever you can.
Absolutely. Yeah, the book is everywhere, and I echo the local bookstore recommendation.
Yeah, and a lot of local bookstores, like our local bookstore here in Fairfield, Revelations Bookstore, is also a wonderful restaurant, so it's combining food and books.
That's so cool.
I know.
Oh, I wish I had that in my town. you have to forgive me if I'm a little out of breath. I just ran downstairs to get my coffee.
Okay.
So I'll read a little bit just from the introduction.
Great.
Okay. Let me just pick. There's a part that I like very much. All right. We're living in a time of upheaval, and the call to activism is loud and clear. In figuring out the shape of my own activism, I keep thinking about heroes, about folks like John Lewis, who don't wait for permission or instruction. I'm constantly reminded that heroes operate in all different ways. Many are loud, while many embody that beautiful Rumi quotation, to raise your words, not voice. It is rain that grows flowers, not thunder. I'll read you just one more other part. But that quotation has always stuck with me. On the most basic level, resistance, just like any other active thing, needs to be fed in order to sustain. Beyond that, food touches on just about every single issue that matters. Being interested in food, really caring about it, has a domino effect. You start caring about where it comes from, what it means to the people you are feeding, and what it means to be fed. To think deeply about food is also to think deeply about the environment, the economy, immigration, education, community, culture, families, race, gender, and identity. Food is about people, all people. It's the most democratic thing in the world, with a lowercase d, and affects all of us. It's the thing we, the entire world, have in common. Therefore, it also has the power to inform us about where we come from, inform how we express and share ourselves, and ultimately has the power to bring us together with empathetic understanding. It's no wonder that bread, fruit, wine, and even water itself are symbols in just about every religion and culture.
Mm. And that's from the introduction of Feed the Resistance, Recipes Plus Ideas for Getting Involved. Let's talk a little bit about the ideas for getting involved, too.
So sure.
You've got 20 places to reach out to.
Yeah.
Then you have 10 ways to engage that aren't so obvious. What's one of those? One of the ways that's maybe not so obvious?
Sure, yeah. So these are these kind of list of resources at the back of the book that are just exactly what you said, just, 10 ways to engage. just all these great lists of all these things you can do. So a good example of that one is baking something simple, cookies, banana bread, zucchini bread, or buying those things. You don't even have to make them, and bring them to first responders in your neighborhood, or even to the folks who work at your local public library, and just thank people for their service. Show up and just remind people that their work is appreciated. That's an easy way to use food to help out. Another way to engage in your community that might not be so obvious is to think about and look into what after-school programs are available in your area. And if there aren't enough and you have an idea for one, start one. Mm. be the change.
Yeah, for working parents, sometimes that after-school time can be very, very challenging to cover, to cover care for their kids during that time.
Absolutely, and having something in your community that you can, rely on, can make just a huge difference in the lives of families in your area.
Yeah. Yeah, there are so many ways to help, very simply, to help make a difference.
Yeah, and the final list that's in the book includes 10 things you can do in less than 10 minutes. there's obviously stories in the book. People have committed their lives to creating change, bettering the world through food, and there's also, this list of things you can do quickly. And the reason that list is there is just to serve as a reminder that you can do something right now. It doesn't have to be huge or daunting. You can do things on a day-to-day basis that don't take up too much time. And it can be as simple as, if you're going out for a meal, just thinking really, thoughtfully about whose restaurant you're going to and whose business you're supporting, and maybe go out of your way to eat a meal at a restaurant run by someone who's different than you, you know, someone mm-hmm. who doesn't look like you or comes from a different place than you come from. You know, if you're going to spend money on a meal outside of your home, you know, it's great to support a women-owned business, an immigrant-run business, an LGBT-owned business. You know, it makes a difference in the lives of those business owners and changes, you know, the landscape.
And I like the number one on this 10 things you can do in less than 10 minutes. Make sure you're registered to vote.
Yeah.
And then make sure your friends are, too. Yeah. Yeah. In some places, it's a little more challenging than others, but... now, the recipes you have grouped in a couple of categories, several categories. You have easy meals for folks who are too busy resisting to cook. And you have some delicious sounding things in there like roasted broccoli and quinoa with curry cashew dressing and spicy tandoori cauliflower with minted yogurt and sheet pan sausage, potatoes, and red cabbage. And then you have feeding the masses, food for crowds. I always considered feeding a crowd really daunting, like a really daunting undertaking. But these recipes seem to make it a little more feasible, a little more approachable.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a running theme through the recipes in both those sections is, you know, it's food that doesn't cost too much to make. It's affordable food. It's really just healthy, just, you know, simple food. And in the feeding the masses section are those Japanese baked sweet potatoes you mentioned. You know, you can make a whole sheet pan of them, and they're so nourishing, and it doesn't cost a lot to make. There's this wonderful pozole recipe that is also, again, just so simple to make. You can make a huge pot and feed a ton of people. Mm-hmm. The People's Grits from the People's Kitchen Collective, that recipe is for 100 people. obviously scale everything down by a zero and make it for a smaller group. You know, it's in there to show that you can serve a big group of people with homemade food that is not complicated to make, but, you know, doesn't cost so much money. You know, it's doable.
And then the last category is my favorite, baked goods and portable snacks. And that's where we have the chocolate espresso pie bars and Persistence biscuits and the pound spice brown sugar pound cake with rum molasses glaze. Wow. Well, Julia, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And are you back to working on the project that you were supposed to be working on when this took its place?
Yes, I am. And it's coming along.
Well, very good. Very good. So hopefully we'll hear from you when that's finished.
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah. All right. Thanks so much for having me on. It was a pleasure to talk to you about this project.
Thank you, Julia. And that was Julia Tertian reading from Feed the Resistance, Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved. And stay tuned now. We have a brief musical interlude, and then we'll be back with our next guest. Thanks, Julia.
Thank you. Have a good one. I really appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley. With me now is a special guest host, Paul Gandy, who is a local attorney here in town and a board member of the Keeping History Alive Foundation. And he's here to help us discuss our next guest book. And our next guest is Paul, would you pronounce your last name for me, Paul?
Kivel.
Paul Kivel. And this book is Uprooting Racism. It's the fourth edition, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. Paul is an award-winning author and an accomplished trainer and speaker and has been a social justice activist, a nationally and internationally recognized anti-racism educator, and an innovative leader in violence prevention for over 40 years. And welcome to Writers' Voices, Paul Kivel and Paul Gandy.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Hi, Paul.
Paul Gandy, do you want to lead off with the questions?
I'm interested, Paul. When was the last moment you spent writing this book before it went off to publishing or to editing?
It was in the spring this year, actually. after the election, after the inauguration, but before the real rhetoric and policies of the current administration were fully revealed to us.
Can you look through the prism of where we are now at through your book and tell us what's going on here?
Well, there's a couple of important things to notice. On the one level, racism is critical to the foundations of our society, starting with slavery and the genocide against Native Americans and the stealing of the land. And so we have a long history of racial inequality. And at the same time, there's always been a huge level of denial among those of us who are white that racism is very serious or that it's really happening. And we went through a period in the after the Civil Rights Movement when white people were saying, well, the Civil Rights Movement took care of all that, and people were talking about a post-racial society. And then again, when Obama was elected, people were saying, well, if we have a black president, what else can we do? That we must be over racism. And the current administration and its rhetoric and policies and its permission for those vast numbers of white people who are still harboring racist ideas or stereotypes and or supporting our institutions, which are perpetuating racism, are much more visible. And so there's a lot more white people, I think, who are realizing that racism did not go away, and yes, it's happening in our neighborhoods and communities, and we have to do something about it. And I wrote my book, I wrote the new edition to provide kind of a toolkit for white people who know that there's something deeply wrong and want to figure out what it is and how to take action.
You know, I remember having a conversation with in a restaurant right after Obama's election with a young, wealthy white man who was telling me that racism was over.
Mm-hmm.
And I was arguing with him because it was obvious to me it wasn't over. But yeah, just the fact that we elected a black president didn't mean that it was the end of racism.
Well, I think that for most of us who are white, we live in very segregated society. Our schools are segregated, our neighborhoods are segregated, our religious congregations are segregated. We don't have a lot of direct contact with people of color, and we get a lot of misinformation in our textbooks and in the media. And so we have this false perception of the world. And at the same time, the levels of racial inequality in our schools, in our job markets, housing markets, healthcare, every institution in our society are really startling and completely unacceptable.
You mentioned your book is a toolkit. People are so busy these days. Paul, if you could, in a few moments, tell us, a few minutes, if you're a person who's concerned about this issue which is so pervasive, what you could do, what three steps, four steps, however you might want to describe it, you could do starting right now to change our society, to help change our society?
I think the work begins with ourselves and in our own homes and schools and neighborhoods. Like I said, most of us are woefully misinformed about racism. And so one level of doing the work is to start really understanding, learning about the history of racism in our communities. Think about whose land are you on? Do you know the history of the land and the native peoples there? How are people treated, people of color treated in your community by the police, by school teachers, by authority figures in general? And the other thing that comes up from this misinformation is the false sense that white people have done everything of importance, that we're the heroes and builders of everything, and therefore we should be in charge. And if we're going to try to get involved with racial justice work, we have to unlearn some of those attitudes of superiority and entitlement that we often bring into the work. So there's some personal work that we need to be doing. The second level is that we need to break the silence in white communities. Silence is complicity, as Black Lives Matter people have said. It's collusion with the status quo. And it's not that as white people we don't talk about racism. Often we do, but it's encoded language. It's not directly about racism, and it's not about how it's actually happening and what we can do about it. So we need to open up these conversations with our children, with our family, with our friends. Over the holidays is a great time to start having conversations about what's going on in our country and in our communities, and begin to do the work with white people that people of color have been asking us to do, the education and mobilizing work.
Now, Paul, you live in the Central or Northern California area, is that right?
Right. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area in Oakland.
And that's a multi-ethnic environment. Is that a fair description?
Yes, although there's a lot of segregation here as well, and certainly a lot of racism.
But I guess my question is, you're calling into a show that's based in Iowa. Iowa is probably 97% Caucasian. Some parts of the state, it's virtually 100%. And so is this book, is your toolkit relevant to people who live in rural areas of the country, which are sometimes uniracial?
Absolutely. So. There's deep racism in all of our communities, and rural communities and small towns are no exceptions. The Midwest is no exception in general. First of all, there's a lot more people of color around than we often notice. But again, the segregation means that they're picking our food in the fields or cleaning houses or taking care of our kids or in the hospitals as nurses or all kinds of ways that there's people of color around. But also, it's the recruiting grounds for not just the Klan, but neo-Nazi groups and other, you know, it's a recruiting ground for support for the racist policies of state and federal governments. There's definitely racism in the healthcare system, in the schools, in your local community, wherever that is, in terms of how people of color are treated. So there's lots of things that we need to get involved with and think about wherever we are. And the book really provides a lot of tools that have to be, of course, adjusted for local circumstances, but the need to do this everywhere is readily apparent. I grew up thinking that, you know, I was on the West Coast in California. I grew up thinking that racism was only in the South, because that's mm-hmm. where there were a lot of people of color, and that's where the struggle was going on, and California, everything was okay. And it took me years before I understood that there was incredible levels of racism in California, not just against African Americans, but against Latinos and Asians and Native peoples. And we need to get over this thing thinking that somehow racism is over there. It's not me, it's not here, it's not now, it's, you know, all those things as white people we do to minimize or deny that racism is a serious problem.
Now, Paul, a lot of good-intentioned white people I'm having trouble with my mic. Okay. A lot of good-intentioned white people will say, oh, I don't see color. Is that necessarily a good thing?
Well, there's two things I would say about that. First of all, we do see color. I thought that that was true of me, that when people of color came to some of us who were white and were outraged about racism, my first response was to say, well, I'm not racist. I treat everybody the same. I'm colorblind, all those things that as white people we do. But then as I watched myself, listened to myself, and noticed my feelings, my physical responses, it was clear that I was noticing racism all the time. When a person of color walked into the room in an all-white space, everybody turns and notices and has a reaction to that. So it's not true that we don't notice race. But the problem is much bigger than whether we notice it or not. The problem is that racism is built into our institutions so that people are treated differently, that white people have access to all kinds of benefits and services that people of color are denied. And so we may or may not see color, but when the police stroll down the street or drive down the street, they are noticing color very, very acutely and treating people of color differently. And when teachers know who their students are, they tend to treat their students of color differently. And we need to look at the institutional impact of those practices as well as our personal take on, you know, what we're noticing or not noticing. The idea is to notice racism. Not to ignore it or pretend like it doesn't exist. People of color live it every day. They have to deal with it. And when we say to them, I don't notice race, we're not noticing part of who they are, the rich cultural heritage that they bring and the cultural specific experiences they bring. So it's actually disrespectful to tell people of color that we don't notice color, because then we're not noticing part of who they are.
And Paul Gandy, as a black man living in a very much white world here in Iowa, do you agree with that?
I think it's a conversation that we need to have. And I think the conversation became more front and center for more Americans, more people, more citizens, more residents of this country when Barack Obama became president. And it's now a level of tension, unfortunately, that's, and in some ways, perhaps fortunately, that's greater now that we have this Donald Trump as president. So a lot of things that Paul says, yeah, I've experienced, I live, I understand, I know.
Paul, what prompted you to write this book in the first place, and when was the first edition?
I wrote my book, Uprooting Racism. It came out in 1996, so I wrote it in the early to mid-90s. I didn't write it for quite a while. I avoided writing it. I said to myself, well, somebody else can do it better, and I'm going to make mistakes. I don't know enough. People will be angry with me. So I'll wait and hope that some other white person steps up and writes a book for white people about racism. And eventually I realized that the reasons I was giving myself for not writing the book were the same reasons that so much of the time we as white people give ourselves for not getting involved in working on racial justice issues. I don't know enough. I'm not ready. It's too hard. I'll make mistakes. People will not like me. And that I had a particular role to play. I had a job to do, if you will, which was to write the best book that I could, using my experience and my knowledge, and that we each have a role to play. And I think that that's so important. Racism can seem big and overwhelming, but none of us are going to solve the whole thing. The question is, what are we going to do? How are we going to stand up and work for racial justice, each taking our own role? And we have roles as parents. We have roles if we're teachers, if we're healthcare workers, if we're wherever we are, we have roles as neighbors, as church members, we need to start doing the work and learning and reaching out to other white people wherever we are, and understanding that we don't have all the answers. We're not going to do it perfectly. A good ally makes mistakes and then apologizes and cleans up the mess and tries it again. So it's really important that we don't use any of those excuses for ways not to get involved in doing this work.
Paul, have you had successes? Are there successes you've had with people using some of the tools in your book that you could talk to us about?
Definitely. All the way, you know, from the simple successes of having conversations with folks around racism that people never thought they would be able to have, to making interventions in their children's schools, to organizing chapters of a national organization we put together called Showing Up for Racial Justice, which is a network of over 175 chapters in different cities of white people working to educate and mobilize other white people around working for racial justice. So it's people found it a very useful set of tools, and different tools, you know, are useful for different folks. But there's a whole section on being how to be an ally, how to show up as an ally. There's a whole section on how to talk with other white people about racism. There's just lots of really concrete and specific things that people can use.
The term white people, the phrase, is interesting because when I was I didn't realize that there were different, I guess you could say, strands of white people, kinds of white people, until I was in college. And I was in college, so-called college in the cradle of liberty, so-called Boston, at Harvard. And there, almost by osmosis, you got the idea that from the history of the school, there were the English, the Irish, the Italian, the Greek, and so forth. These ethnic strains were different in some way, and to be treated differently. And there was even a hierarchy, and it was sort of not taught explicitly at that university, but it certainly had that history. I think it's changed significantly over the years, but it certainly had that history of sort of in the bricks, if you will. Now, at the beginning of your book, I think you talked about people not actually seeing themselves as white. They may see themselves as, I'm Italian, for example, or I'm Irish. Could you talk to the audience here about what you meant by that and why you came to the, I think you came to the conclusion, yeah, but actually, when it comes down to it, in certain instances, you're white.
Right. I think that, you know, it comes back to this wanting to deny that we're involved, that we're connected to this. And so we may say, I'm not racist, but another way we do that denial is say, well, I'm not really white. I'm, you know, of a different ethnicity. And that's another way of saying that I'm not part of what's going on. And I think that is a big stumbling block for a lot of us. And if you think about who made your clothes, if you think about who makes our cell phones and computers, if you think about who grows so much of our food, who does the work of cleaning our buildings and things like that, taking care of people in our families and rest homes and hospitals and things like that, that so much of that work is done by people of color, mostly very low paid, very difficult work, and our lives are intricately connected to the lives of people of color, even if they're invisible to us. And so to say that I'm not benefiting as a white person, whether I'm have heritage that's Greek or Italian or Jewish or whatever, if I'm white and am perceived as white in the institutions that I live in, then I am gaining benefits on a daily way from racism, from the way it works in our society. And that deeply damages our integrity if we're not doing something to address that. And so I think it's important that there's just a lot of ways that we want to skirt around this and claim that it's not our issue, or that this doesn't really affect us, or that we're innocent and there's some other bad people out there who are the racists, the neo-Nazis or whatever. But we're all in this together. We have mutual interest in building a society that really takes care of all of us.
And not to mention, even if racism really did end today, there's still the cumulative effect of the past benefits.
Right. We have to take that into account, which is one reason that we have to talk about reparations, and we have to talk about Native American land claims and sovereignty, that it's not an overnight phenomenon that it will magically disappear, because we have literally hundreds of years of legacy of the inequalities built on top of each other.
There's a book that came out last year called Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at it, but he speaks of, he calls himself a hillbilly, coming from the hills of Kentucky and later Ohio. He ends up going to Yale Law School, but that culture in which he was raised still draws on him. And he didn't say it so much in the book, but I think part of the undercurrent, when he didn't deal too much with race or color in the book, other than the referred to his family, his culture as poor and white. But what about the argument, the response, I suspect you may have heard that, well, race, why are we focusing so much on race or color or racism? I mean, there are people who are white who have it bad enough as it is. They're not getting this special treatment. Why should some other group get some special treatment?
Well, I think that certainly comes up a lot. It's another way to kind of step away from addressing racism head on. Racism is an economic issue. It started out as a strategy of the ruling class to separate white indentured servants from African indentured servants in the colonies in Virginia in the 17th century, and it's still used today to divide us from each other, so that rather than looking at the tremendous levels of inequality in our country, it's now true that there's three white Christian men who own as much wealth as half of the U.S. population. That's 160 million own as much as three men. But yet we don't see that or notice that enough. What we do is we turn our attention towards recent immigrants or African Americans or Muslims or all kinds of other things, and racism is still being used to divide us around economic issues. So I think it's really important that one of the costs of racism to white people is that we're divided from our natural allies in making economic changes. The problem with the book, I think, is that it really makes it seem like poor and working class folks are the problem, whereas actually the current administration was put into office also by a lot of middle class and upper middle class and wealthy white people who supported the current president and the policies that are coming down, and that we need to not blame poor and working class people for racism. They are the victims as much of this as people of color are. The people who are benefiting, most of the benefits from racism are going to the top of the economic pyramid, not to the bottom.
I remember when I was in college, I was a research assistant for a professor who was studying busing in Chicago, if you remember that back in the late 70s. Uh-huh. And the busing was from working class black neighborhoods to working class white neighborhoods. It was organized, it was arranged by upper class Bostonians, the ones who lived in the suburbs. Their children weren't being bused, their children weren't being uprooted, but they thought it would be a good idea to make this, to force this policy on other people to help integrate the schools. It created a tremendous amount. I understand there were benefits, I suspect, but it created a tremendous amount of tension in the city and unfortunately harmed the kids, harmed the children.
Right, and basically a lot of the wealthier white people pulled their children out of public schools and into independent schools or private schools precisely because they wanted to keep them in white, primarily predominantly white environments. And the result was a lot of racial tension between working class and poor white people, and mostly working class and poor people of color. And so that's a really good example of how racism works against most of our interests. And I really wrote the book to talk about those dynamics so that we can begin to see what it costs us and what our stake is in working for racial justice.
It's an interesting point. You make the point, and I think you say it more than once in your book, that racism has a cost, not just for people who are the objects or suffer racism. All of us suffer because of racism. All of us, the whole community.
Right. And I think that that's a strong message that I want to get across in my book, Uprooting Racism, is that, you know, when toxic waste is dumped into communities of color in our cities and countrysides and counties, it doesn't stay in those communities. That toxic air and that toxic water, we see this over and over again. When the people at Standing Rock were defending the water, they were defending the water for all the people downstream on the rivers that those oil spills are going to impact. And so the other thing that we need to acknowledge is that people of color are often on the front lines of defending not just their own communities, but defending all of our communities, because racism doesn't have boundaries like that. The other thing that I really wanted to get across in my book is that there's a long history of some white people showing up for racial justice, going back to the colonial days and the abolition movement, the civil rights movement, but not nearly enough of us. And so a lot of our work as white people is to reach out and break that silence and to really help other white people step up and join the forces of people of color who are already out doing things, working for racial justice, so we can actually shift this country in ways that will benefit all of us.
Are you optimistic, Paul?
I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I mean, I think this is really important times. We're facing major, major challenges economically, environmentally, etc. And at the same time, there's tremendous resistance and organizing and creative work going on in communities of color and in around a lot of different issues. There's more white people stepping up all of the time and looking for resources, which is a main reason why I wrote my book, a new edition of the book. Things are, moving, changing, and I can't predict where they're going to go. It's up to you and me and everybody else who's listening.
Well, we only have about 1 minute left. Paul, what would you say is the biggest change, positive or negative, from when you first wrote this book to today?
I think the biggest change since I wrote the first edition over 20 years ago was that there was so much denial then that racism was a central issue. And today it is so visible. The current administration and its rhetoric and policies is making it so in our faces, and the cell phone images of black people being murdered by police and the struggles at Standing Rock, that more and more people are waking up and saying, yes, something is deeply wrong. This is not the society we want to live in. We want to live in a society that nurtures and sustains and heals and provides equity and justice for all of us. And that's a very promising sign. And my book, Uprooting Racism, is meant to be a guide, a resource, a handbook for how we can step up and really make a difference in the world.
Thank you, Paul Kivel. Thank you, Paul Gandy. Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice by Paul Kivel. Stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild and see you next week on Writer's Voices. And thank you so much for being with us, Paul.
Yes,
sure.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for having me. Is there a way that I can...
Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.
Hello, this is Jonathan.